everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report here under lockdown on a Wednesday. They say, the legend is, that Wednesdays are big news days, and today certainly is. And so we've come packing a J.R. Jackson. How's it going, J.R.?
What's up? I have some big news. I mean, I don't know how many of you guys saw the Hero special last night. It was quite lovely, quite schmoopy. Cenk, I'm sure, enjoyed all that part,
those aspects
of it. Yeah. And, you know, and John had a very heartfelt hero that he went out. But, you know, I want to make sure that we all know. Sometimes when you meet someone else's heroes, it's good to relay the stories and tell you how awesome they were in person. But it's also a good idea to make sure that you don't ever meet your heroes, because you never know. They could be a pain in the butt in person. And you may not love them anymore, John.
Yeah.
So I think the route that you've gone with your hero is the best route.
Yeah, I didn't even want to meet her, really. Oh, God, why did you do this? It's like the one week, the one Wednesday, where before the show, JR isn't bragging about, like, getting into better shape while I'm falling apart physically. He's like, oh, by the way, you've never met your hero. Yeah, well, I've met other heroes of mine. I met Bernie Sanders, and I shook his hand, and it was fairly clear in that moment that he didn't know who I was. So that was cool. Anyway, if you haven't already seen it, I'm not sure if it's available to everyone or just to members, but you should definitely take a look if you're looking for something. Just feel good. It is a feel-good special, and we had a lot of fun with it. And thank you to everybody who's already here. Please hit the like button, share the stream if you haven't already. Many of you are not, because there's a couple thousand here and only 436 likes. Come on, people. You can do it. I believe in you. It's right in front of you, unless you're like on a TV or something. I don't know how that works. But please like if you can. I am going to be more controlled in this episode, I think. But we're going to start off with me being technically out of control, because in my, you know, happiness of talking to JR before the show, I forgot to do one thing that I'm supposed to do before the show starts. So I'm just going to give you a little preview of what's going on here, and I'm going to try to fix this real fast. This is, oh, nope, that was not right. Okay, we're being very professional today on the show. Oh my God, I'm ruining everything. I'm falling apart.
John, the people love you. You can actually do no wrong.
There we go. Thanks. It's just little things like adjusting the graphics thing. Why do you have to do that? I don't know. It's stupid, but I have to do it and I forgot. So anyway, with that, feel free to send us tweets and comments and super chats, and we'll be responding to those. For those of you who were watching live yesterday's show, many of you sent super chats. And as I explained at the time, I could not read them just because it was too difficult, but I do appreciate all of them, and I did read all of them, if not out loud. And so thank you for that. I went back through after the show and read them all once I was, you know, in control of myself and everything. And so I do appreciate that. And with that, why don't we launch into this thing, JR?
Do it.
Donald Trump is pro-mask all of a sudden, and he wants you to know it loud and proud. He loves the mask.
Well, I do actually do it when I need. I mean, I carry the mask when I have to go. I went into Walter Reed Hospital the other day. I have the mask right here, and I carry it, and I will use it gladly. No problem with it. And I've said that, and I say, if you can, use the mask. When you can, use the mask. If you're close to each other, if you're in a group, I would put it on. When I'm in a group, I have no problem with the masks. I view it this way. Anything that potentially can help, and that certainly can potentially help, is a good thing. I have no problem. I carry it. I wear it. You saw me wearing it a number of times, and I'll continue, please.
So, if you can... okay, so, look, a lot to take issue with. The overall thing is he's saying he wears a mask, you should wear a mask. We'll delve into how accurate that is. But, JR, should we drop the balloons and fire the fireworks and... all of that. Should I start doing some sort of Fortnite dance?
I mean, if that'll help stop the spread and limit the spread of COVID, yes, do all of it. This is an indication that someone got through to him to a point where he should at least act like he cares enough about mask wearing to say it to people. That's the stage we've gotten to. We've definitely not gotten to the stage where he believes it's helpful. We've definitely not gotten to the stage where he thinks that it's no longer a sign of weakness. He doesn't think that either. This is... Okay, you guys, I finally believe the poll numbers that I'm seeing, that everything is a disaster for me. So I need to start doing things that aren't the opposite of trying to help save people's lives. When people say something, I should actually listen. He started that part, but he definitely doesn't believe in it. I think we'll find that out as we go further.
I think so. I mean, it was so begrudging. The, like, you know, I do, you know, if I'm on an elevator, if you can, I guess, wear one, maybe it'll help me a little bit. I don't know. He's not actually sold on it. And that's not just, like, an observation to, like, you know, pick at what he said. It's also substantive. Like, him going up there and now saying, if you can, you should, in these limited circumstances, is simply not as good of a message as, you know, saying to the 30% of the country that thinks masks are a plot of Beelzebub, who is the devil, who, by the way, all wear red hats, to say, you need to wear a mask, all of you. Put your mask on. If you're around anyone, put your mask on. Do it. Stick to it. And we can get through this. And you can get your liberties back. And we can have the economy back and all that. That would be a more effective message. Now, this is better than anything he's had so far. But I am also not going to, as much of the media has, and we're going to get to that in a few minutes, start lavishing praise on him. Because I don't think it's justified. Especially when he's not only undercutting his message in the way he delivers it, but also in his appearances. So immediately after that section, he's asked a question. Are you sending mixed messages, though? Yesterday, you tweeted out an image wearing a mask, and then last evening, we saw you not wearing a mask at your hotel. And he responded, well, I don't know. No, but I know. You're saying it, but you're not actually doing it. You wore the mask at Walter Reed, and then you put up a photo where you called it the China virus, where you were wearing a mask. And that is good, because in the hellscape that is 2020, that's, I guess, the best we can hope for. But when you're seen constantly not wearing masks, when you have rallies where people are all not wearing masks and you're not telling them to, that's an issue. And one more question he got. A lot of Americans are maybe surprised at your change of tone, something we'll return to in just a few minutes, over all of this. Some more perhaps realistic tone. Some will look at it that way, the sudden embrace of masks, social distancing. And he says, no, I've always agreed with that. I mean, I've never fought either one, but certainly social distancing. I want to. That's common sense. 6 feet to me is common sense. I'd like to say maybe it a little bit further. Oh. No, but and here's the thing. I'm not going to do the thing that I was inclined to do, which is to go back in all the ways that he was mocking people for wearing masks and attacking it and saying it's unnecessary and all of that. But you know that it's out there. If you're paying attention, if you're watching the show, you already know it. He is simply lying.
It's a traditional childlike lie. Whenever, or trying to come back from the previous lie, he goes, you know, yeah, no, I'm totally for 6 feet, 6 feet, 8. Let's make it 10 feet. Why not? Ah! Let me just push it further to make it. I want to make sure you guys really know I'm on board for 6 feet. In fact, let's go 10. That doesn't really mean that you're more down for the cause just because you decide to push the length further. That doesn't mean anything. Yeah. It's such an empty addition to the policy.
Exactly. Well, you know, one good empty addition to the policy deserves another. And thus we turn to Kellyanne Conway. Defended the president's turn on masks, but she sort of doubled down, implying, as Trump tried to, in sort of a clumsy way, that no, he's always been for masks.
I think for the president himself to provide that information to the public and to very humbly and forthrightly come forward and say, look, it's going to get worse before it gets better, wear a mask, socially distance, do these things that are important. And I would say to all those people out there who are resisting wearing a mask, listen, folks, it costs nothing. It takes 2 seconds. And you'll get your liberties back sooner if you wear your mask.
But Kellyanne, I mean, you know, I guarantee that there are people at home who listen to that and say, why didn't the White House have this message for all of us, you know, 2 months ago? Why now? Why wasn't this, you know, pushed and emphasized and encouraged by the president back then, where it might have made even more of a difference?
The president did say in April, if people want to wear a mask, they should wear a mask. We did have our health professionals early on saying it wouldn't help. And we know now that it would. We have additional studies. I was in the Oval Office yesterday when Dr. Birx was briefing the president.
Yeah, we have additional studies. It took until mid-late July for us to get the additional studies to know that you should wear a mask to not spread germs. And they do the thing they always do, which is Trump said early on, if you want to, you can. Great. You know, round of applause. And then she mashes that up with some of the health professionals said it wouldn't help early on. those are equal things. Like on February 1st, 1917, it's like so far back now in the pandemic. There was like one quote where it was like, don't buy up all the masks, health professionals need them. And they will always now hold that out to mean that all of medical science and doctors are only as accurate maybe as Trump, who said, hey, if you want to, you can.
Which he's still saying now, gotta be honest.
Yeah. That's not that dissimilar.
If it works for you, then maybe you can. And also the whole time, I mean, he's had rallies. He's talked about how he wants people to pack next to each other. How stupid would it be if there was 6 feet between each of the people at my rallies? He said it. He said consistently how much he's against it. And if he have to say it in a sobering tone now, it doesn't mean anything differently. If you say once, maybe, possibly, and you want to, an outside chance, if you feel like it, maybe doing it, saying that once versus 200 other times saying it's ridiculous, you look weak, you're not a real American, how dare you, snowflake. If you say that many more times, it doesn't equal out. It just doesn't. And also, by the way, if Kellyanne said he's been consistently doing this the whole time or he's always been on board, why did he, even in his admission now, say, I mean, I have no problem with masks. If anybody who, you know who's never going to have to say, I've had no problem with masks? John Adarola, anyone else, like anyone who's on board, who's been on board with this from the beginning, is not going to get asked later. So how do you feel about masks now, John? Your answer would be, I mean, if you check out everything I've said, I've always said that we should wear masks, we should social distance, we should stay quarantined, stay home, keep things closed until things happen because the science says so. If you ever respond to that question by saying, I mean, I have no problem with masks, that means that at some point you did. Mm-hmm. Why would you bring up a problem with masks? Who had a problem with masks? You did.
And why would you have a problem with masks? Like, if your house is on fire and the firemen are standing on the street looking at your house and you go up and you're like, hey, why aren't you spraying it? And they're like, well, I got no problem with water, but no, then show me by spraying it. And also, it's so specifically untrue. I got no problem with masks. You remember the Chris Wallace interview from way back, like 2 days ago, where he was like, masks cause problems too. Sounded like you had a problem with masks. Lo, these 48 hours ago. Look, I hope that they've all actually changed over. I feel like we shouldn't rewrite history. We have to make clear what they did and didn't do. But I hope for everyone's sake that they have switched. You know, I have a family member still in the hospital in Florida, thanks to coronavirus. We're now hearing the possibility that another family member got sick because someone at their workplace that was working very close by refused to wear masks. We need the message to be uniform, even if it's delivered in a dishonest and bumbling and moronic and anti-scientific way like it is right now.
And let's keep it real. I'm sorry, my last thought on this. So if they think this is now the switch that's going to get them into the re-election mode, Meta, because they've realized how badly he's doing. So they expect people to then forget the several months of anti-health concerns and health protocols that they've been looking to push and his pushback against the experts that have said these things. Mm-hmm. They expect you to forget all that and somehow believe that he's always been on the right side and that now he should be reelected. They expect that. And for people who say, I'm not listening to him anymore, they're going to say, hey, but he's saying the right things. You're just being anti-Trump. That's where this conversation is going to go next.
Yeah, and I wonder, like we've said, you know, how much power we think he has over his base. In this particular case, I hope that he does, but we'll see. It, like if you printed out the card and you've gone to Trader Joe's and spat in people's face because that's your political identity now, I hope that Trump can turn you. We'll find out. But let's zoom out a little bit and talk about the conversation about what you just saw. The media has from the very beginning looked to pretend that Donald Trump is more reasonable, more presidential once he was elected than he actually is. And we see them falling into that trap once again as these COVID press conferences begin. Now, to his credit, Trump said that things are likely to get worse before they get better. Kind of wish he'd said that at the very beginning. If he'd acknowledged it and taken it seriously, maybe the worst wouldn't have been quite as bad as it was. And he is now saying that people should wear masks. And because he did that, the media has been saying things like on ABC News Politics, the president is displaying a new tone and a new level of engagement. Reuters, President Trump, in a shift in rhetoric and tone, encouraged Americans to wear masks. I can just see the football being put out in front of him and the media running up to kick it, and he's going to pull it out. But it's not just like the social media managers of two, you know, news outlets, all over the media, like the morning shows, it's been new tone, substantive change, rhetoric shift, a swing in approach, a new gravitas. It's been over and over and over and over again. And JR, I'm sure you, like I, hope that that's true. Maybe because it's in his political interests, it will be. Maybe he'll defy everything we know about him and his movement.
By doing what? By continuing down this line of reading from the teleprompter, what they told him to prepare to say. I'm going to give a
general prediction.
I don't like giving predictions because who knows, right? But it's what's going to happen. Of course, the media jumped back on being his buddy and his pal because for some reason they still want validation from him. But or they want to be seen as being fair. But this is going to turn into another campaign event. He said he's going to do these more frequently. Look, I got more of these planned. We're going to be talking about things like the economy. So if you're going to come back and start talking about things like the economy, you're going to start talking about how you are going to try and pose this election again, because his only campaign message was the economy is so awesome. The campaign is so awesome.
Yeah.
Great. I've created an economy when this country was a third world country until I showed up. He's pushing that rhetoric. So he's not able to have his campaign events. And we saw what he did with the other press conference when he turned into a campaign event bashing on Biden.
Yeah.
This is going to be a continuing campaign event where he's going to try and pose himself as this person who's done these things and this someone else hasn't done these things or can't do these
things.
This is going to turn into the same thing he's always done, back to him.
If you're right, JR, then it is important that we have a media that will understand the full context of who he is and how honest he and his media representatives, Kellyanne Conway and Kayleigh McEnany, are. And so we don't have that, but here is what we have.
Change in tone from the president.
President Trump takes a somber new tone.
The president to adopt this different tone.
We're seeing a drastic change in tone.
The change in tone.
The president changing his tone.
And a shift in tone.
A real shift in tone for the president.
The shift in tone from the White House.
A more serious tone.
And a change of tone.
President Trump sharply changed his tone.
President Trump is also significantly changing his tone.
A tone of seriousness from the president.
Okay, we could go on for a long time, and The Daily Show has a video of that that's even longer. That's in less than a day. How did there's online thesauruses you could go to and you could get other words to express the same naivete if you want to. I don't know how they could all land on the same thing. It's Donald Trump. Yes, he wore the mask. He implied that it's patriotic. That is good. Thank you, kind sir. And I hope that he sticks with it. Because it matters, because so many lives are on the line. But who knows what he's going to say at the next COVID press conference? Who knows what he's going to tell you to inject into your body?
Yeah. So once you're, you know, if you're an anchor on one of these shows, John, you get that script and that teleprompter to read. Trump's changing tone. Trump's changing tone. His change in tone has been stark change in tone. You'd have to give some, I mean, I would, and maybe they'd be upset me, insert some kind of caveat. It's like, oh, I'm reading that they're saying Trump has a change in tone, which many believe could be fake, considering his past comments on this. Like, you got to give some context that this change in tone came from a disastrous tone that was completely disregarding this entire pandemic. And as anyone who is following the orders that he's now saying we should do, kind of, that those people are un-American.
Yeah.
Keep it real.
Come on, media. There's an election on. We need you to be better.
You can say there's a change in tone, but at least tell us what the previous tone was and for how long it was there.
That's true. Yeah, if you want to give him credit. And look, maybe Reuters and ABC News are doing a version of what we're doing, which is, okay, this guy is a four-year-old. We have to pat him on the head. That's the only way he's going to stick with it. Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
But don't forget what he's already done and how many people have died as a result of it. That's all I'm saying. We want to warn you that this clip contains content that some may find distressing or disturbing, including graphic references to sexual abuse, assault, and violence. At his new press conferences, Donald Trump was asked a question about something in the news. Ghislaine Maxwell, the associate and apparent groomer of all of these underage women for Jeffrey Epstein, is now being charged with a number of crimes. Here's Donald Trump being asked about that, and take a look at the way he responds.
Ghislaine Maxwell is in prison, and so a lot of people want to know if she's going to turn in powerful people. And I know you've talked in the past about Prince Andrew and you've criticized Bill Clinton's behavior. I'm wondering, do you feel that she's going to turn in powerful men? How do you see that working out?
I don't know. I haven't really been following it too much. I just wish her well, frankly. I've met her numerous times over the years, especially since I lived in Palm Beach, and I guess they lived in Palm Beach. But I wish her well, whatever it is. I don't know the situation with Prince Andrew. Just don't know. Not aware of it.
Okay, so we're going to return to the Prince Andrew part where he says he doesn't know anything about that situation in a bit. Let's focus now on the fact that this woman who is, you know, she hasn't been convicted yet, I guess, she's been charged with raping multiple women. One woman says that Maxwell raped her 20 to 30 times. And Trump responded by saying, I wish her well. Multiple times he said it. She's an accused rapist. And the president, in an official press conference, responded, I wish her well. Think about how he's talked about other criminals who've done crimes far less severe than raping, you know, a crowd of people. What a weird, what a bizarre thing to just, just move past it.
Yeah, think about what he said about people who aren't criminals, who've been accused of crimes that have been explicitly exonerated of those crimes. What he continues to this day to think and say about those people.
Yeah.
Central Park 5 is the example I'm going with here. He still holds on to the belief that, hey, they admitted it, so therefore they're guilty. I don't know why we're still talking about this. It's a disaster, and it's a nightmare that they gave money to these guys that were wrongfully convicted and spent jail time, years of their life in jail over this.
Yeah.
So, that's his response to this, them. But this is, I wish her well.
And so the obvious follow-up question is this him signaling to her in response to a question about whether powerful people will be revealed by her to have been involved? Is this him signaling, you know, I wish you well, wink, wink, be good, and maybe you get a pardon too?
That's what Dana Bash and a few other folks have been saying, which I did read this morning. So there's those, the same term was apparently used when mentioning Roger Stone, when talking about Paul Manafort, two of his associates that were guilty of their crimes. And he looked to assist in helping them get beyond because there's connections to their crimes that connect to him. And I saw the, not even sneaky, but because it's obvious, but the way that that reporter asked the question and brought up Bill Clinton and brought up Prince Andrew, right? He's not going to bring up Donald Trump because Donald Trump will get super defensive and then say, get out of here. I can't believe fake news. Mm-hmm. So he set him up with maybe an enemy of his, Bill Clinton, who was his friend, by the way, who set him up with this so he could at least answer in a way that would have more of a non-aggressive tone to it, as we're talking about tone today.
That was clever. Yeah. And so he, I like maybe signal he's pardoning her if, but even if that's not what he's doing, where's QAnon on all this? Like, the associate of one of the most notorious pedophiles, Trump, officially says, I wish her well. This whole movement, crazy people around the world who find pedophiles under every rock and believe that there is a multi-decade-long political organization working behind the scenes to weed out all these pedophiles. Trump's like, yeah, she's nice. Hope she does well. Like, and they don't have a problem with that. God, what a dumb but also corrupt and hypocritical movement.
Yes, absolutely.
But anyway, let's also talk about Prince Andrew, because the thing is, he didn't deny knowing Ghislaine Maxwell. That'll come in a month or two. For now, he still knows who she is. He did deny knowing anything about the Prince Andrew thing, which you have to admit on its face is a little bit odd, considering that it was major news. But also considering that he definitely knows about it, because people have been able to find footage such as this. From 2015, him being asked about the island.
The question of Jeffrey Epstein in your remarks about in the Q&A.
Well, I think he's
Sean.
Got a problem. I mean,
what do you think
I'm
the problem
hearing.
Will be?
I don't know, but that island was really a cesspool. There's no question about it. Just ask Prince Andrew. He'll tell you about it.
What? Why are you asking Prince Andrew about it? What will he tell you since you don't know anything about it? How did you know about it in 2015?
See, and
yeah, he brought it up unprompted. The guy didn't mention Prince Andrew. He thought of Prince Andrew. That is how closely he associates Prince Andrew and that island. But now, I don't know. I don't know anything about it. I don't know anything about it at all. Which is weird, because, let's see, we also have this footage. This is from December of last year, I believe.
Or who?
Prince Andrew stepping down from the royal duties.
No, I don't know Prince Andrew. But it's a tough story. It's a very tough story. I don't know him. No.
Okay, so the reason we bring that up is he acknowledges he knows the story back in December of last year, but in doing so said, I don't know Prince Andrew. That's when you know someone's in trouble, when Trump doesn't remember them anymore.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just a sign of his brain being Swiss cheese, it's a sign of him trying to distance himself from it, which is going to be hard to do when you have a documented history of being involved with this person going back to, for instance, the year 2000, when he said of Prince Andrew, he's not pretentious, he's a lot of fun to be with.
To do what? To be with? Or is it not fun to watch from afar and hear about him in news stories? Or is
exactly. No, to be with him at a party, because that was from People in 2000, and they were profiling a party that Trump and Melania were at, and they were partying with Prince Andrew and one other person. I forget who it was. It was Ghislaine Maxwell, actually, that they were all partying with in 2000. He's saying he's a lot of fun to be with at that party that he was at with the woman who he's now being asked about. Now, bear in mind, Trump has a long history of claiming that he doesn't know somebody when they become politically dangerous. You might recall Gordon Sondland, his ambassador to the EU. After he gave unfavorable testimony, Trump just couldn't remember who he was anymore. And that's not the only one. You might also remember that he didn't know Giuliani's Ukrainian associates, despite having multiple dinners with them and having more pictures with them than I literally have with my own dog. He said at the time, I don't know them. I don't know about them. I don't know what they do. I don't know. Maybe you'd have to ask Rudy. This is people who gave tons of money to his inauguration. And he was with so many times that he doesn't know them. Which really, JR, brings this all back to the beginning, because you might recall that he also didn't know Jeffrey Epstein, despite back in 2002 saying, I've known Jeff for 15 years. Terrific guy. He's a lot of fun to be with. Who else has he said that about? It is even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side. No doubt about it, Jeffrey enjoys his social life. But that was in 2002, after all the stuff comes out. He says he had no relationship with Epstein. Yeah, the relationship evaporated.
So has anyone, maybe I've missed it, has a reporter asked him about that quote?
I don't know.
Have they said, hey, what does that mean? What does that mean? Because, again, you're talking about how he doesn't know people. Even in this answer, this answer to the question that he probably shouldn't have answered about Ghislaine. So he said, hey, I mean, I guess they lived in West Palm Beach, or not West, but lived in Palm Beach like I did. So I guess you guess they live in Palm Beach. You guess they were nearby. You guess you run across them a couple of times. Bro, you've had quotes about how you've partied with them and the kind of girls. Young girls,
yes,
he likes to have around him. You've said it. So now you guess you've heard of them because they live in Palm Beach when you lived in Palm Beach? Just a random coincidence. Yeah, I stepped outside one time to get the mail and I saw Jeffrey and Yidlan out there and I was like, oh, how you guys doing? You new to the neighborhood? No, yeah. That's not how it went down.
No.
I'd like to borrow some sugar next week, neighbor.
Exactly. And look, I don't know. He obviously partied with them. And he knew about Jeffrey Epstein. He admitted it in that quote. And he's saying the same things about Prince Andrew. And Prince Andrew also was using those connections to sexually assault underage women. That does not mean necessarily that Trump was involved in this. We don't know. We have no idea. But knowing who Trump is and things he said about women, it isn't a massive leap.
Trump's
to be able to imagine that he could be concerned.
His pattern for lying is it tracks right here. Mm-hmm. All of a
exactly. And we don't know. We honestly don't know. We'll see what happens. But the idea that this guy is potentially dangling a pardon over her head to keep her silent when he has already shown that he is willing to pardon people who lie and obstruct justice to conceal his crimes, that's concerning. We're concerned about that. Now, Trump is not the only one who had weird things to say about Ghislaine Maxwell yesterday. You also have Fox News' Geraldo Rivera tweeting, when asked, real Donald Trump said he wished Ghislaine Maxwell arrested well. With media mob eager to see her lynched, it was brave to weigh in. Fact, cases versus her are for crimes allegedly committed more than 25 years ago. She deserved bail and got solitary confinement. Woke politics. I don't know what the last part of that means, except that on the right wing you just call everything you don't like woke politics. But why is Geraldo Rivera, this isn't the first time, we talked about it a couple weeks ago when she was first charged, he just keeps weighing in to say that people are being unfair to her. Why is that?
Unsolicited, like no one asked him, no one no one tagged Geraldo in any kind of post to ask him what his thoughts are on Maxwell and whether or not she should be out, or what Trump's answer was in wishing her well, which was brave. Okay, so it's brave to wish an accused and jailed child rapist and child sex trafficker well. That's brave? Maybe I should sift through Geraldo's tweets and see where he defended other child rapists that were in jail and child sex traffickers that were in jail. I'm looking for this track of this bravery in defending child rapists. Mm-hmm. Where's the brave part? Because people are going to call him out? That's brave? So when you defend a criminal, I'm going to go ahead and say it, but alleged criminal, when you defend them, that's brave? What's the brave part about that?
I don't know. And you're totally right. It's not like everyone is desperate to know what he thinks about this. He just feels the need to weigh in. And it's not like Geraldo does give oddball takes from time to time. And I have no idea. Like the thing that everybody says, and we're seeing some of that in the comments right now, is that obviously he's on the list. I have no idea. But I will say that it is a bizarre take when you say the crimes were all 25 years ago. Like, she's accused of having raped kids. I don't care if it was 25 years ago. I don't care if it was 75 years ago. It's not just water under the bridge. It's rape. It's mass rape. And grooming women and psychologically torturing them and making them know that their lives will be destroyed if they don't let other men rape them. I don't care if it was 2.5 decades ago. That's not that long ago. I watch episodes of Seinfeld from that time. I think we can still consider those things crimes.
And I said it last time. So what is it about 25 years that makes the trauma of being trafficked, raped, and passed around to disgusting old rapist men? What? So that means it goes away? Where's the scientific evidence for all, though, that 25 years eliminates a lifetime of trauma and many times detriment to your entire health? In life, people kill themselves over this type of stuff. People never have healthy relationships over this. People can't move on through life without not getting by this trauma.
Yeah.
What is it about 25 years that means everything is better?
Yeah. And I would say that if anyone gets to decide if it's better, it's not Geraldo. It's all of the people who were raped by these monsters. Yesterday, the acting Secretary of Homeland Security had a quote that a lot of people immediately thought brought to mind sci-fi movies like Minority Report. I want to show you this. Chad Wolf being asked about the fact that his mostly anonymous camoed soldiers that have been deployed to Portland and soon coming to other cities are just snatching people off the streets.
Anytime that you attack a federal facility such as a courthouse there in Portland, that is a federal crime. Attacking federal police officers, law enforcement officers, which they have done for 52 nights in a row, is a federal crime. And so the department, because we don't have that local support, that local law enforcement support, we are having to go out and proactively arrest individuals. And we need to do that because we need to hold them accountable. This idea that they can attack federal property and law enforcement officers and go to the other side of the street and say, you can't touch me, is ridiculous.
So, yeah, a lot of people thought that having this person who has an incredible amount of apparently unchecked and uncheckable power to brutalize people around the country, saying that they're going to do proactive arrests, that is not how our system is supposed to work. Do you think that he just misspoke?
No. There's like people at this level, and you just mentioned speaking off the cuff because we're doing this show, and you know the term you used, Warren, versus the actual reality of the situation, it comes in speaking. People at this level, when you're on TV and you have a policy and you're implementing this thing where you're carrying out in the cities, you don't misspeak on something like that. You're saying what your policy is. And it tracks because he also said, I don't care what governors and mayors of cities have to say, we're going to come in and do what we want in your cities and in your states. That wasn't misspeaking either. That's what his policy is. Mm-hmm. His policy is also this, that we're going to, he didn't use the word preemptively, proactively start arresting people. Okay, I've seen many posts from police officers in Facebook groups saying what they want to do to citizens and the violent acts they're going to do to them, which are quite illegal. Are we going to proactively start arresting these officers that we've seen saying these things? Because that's a crime. They're planning it. They said they're willing to do it. I think to protect the citizens, we need to start arresting these cops. Every time we see them say something that's illegal, some kind of action, if they want to do that's illegal, on a Facebook page. Hey, what if they are caught on body cam saying they're going to do something to these guys? Or, hey, we're going to, you know, we've seen them talk about what they're going to do to people and laugh and joke about it. Pretty illegal, I think, to assault protesters that aren't doing anything to you. Are we going to start arresting them before they do it?
Yeah.
No, but we can do it to citizens because we were trying to protect. I'm not sure which facilities we're talking about protecting here. Outside of
some statue or election things. Yeah, they can and they do. And that's the thing where, like, the reason this quote really struck people is not because, oh, we got him because he said it. No, they've already done it. We have the footage of them just rolling up on people, grabbing people. There's nothing going on. There's no protest. There's no riot or anything like that. They grab people, they put them in the truck, and they drive them off. That is a proactive arrest. I don't care if he finesses his language later on. That's what it is. And people are rightfully horrified. I want to show you a video from Portland. This is from just last night, by the way. This was Joshua Potash on Twitter had this. Take a look at this, and you tell me if this is what the relationship between the U.S. military is supposed to be with American citizens who are protesting.
Watch behind you, behind you, behind you, behind you. Come on, get. Watch out, watch out.
Yeah, if I had told you that that was footage taken on, you know, the streets of an Iraqi city back during the surge, you would have believed it.
Mm-hmm.
Totally needless. And when we have these concerns, when we express them, as we have been for some time, they respond by saying, like Chad Wolf saying, our federal agents will not retreat. What do you mean retreat?
Retreat.
This isn't the Battle of the Bulge. What are you talking about? We're saying stop kidnapping people. Stop brutalizing people. You're not in a battle. I need him to confirm that he knows that this is not a battle that he's involved in. That they're supposed to be guarding statues.
He can't confirm that because that's not what he believes. He does believe it's a battle. They're amped about this battle. They put these guys in military fatigues. Think about it. They got them in camo. What's camo for? They got like desert camo on, at least from some of the ones that ran up and snatched people and threw them into vans. They got desert camo on. Camouflage is to blend in with the surroundings so you can't be detected as well. What part about the city of Portland has desert and sand all over the place where you have to blend in with the background to make sure that the enemy residents of Portland notice you coming? No, this is an intimidation look. You walk in there with your big guns and your camo, and people have this respect for the military, and that's what you're posing as. Because people go, oh man, I guess I can't do anything about this because I don't know who they are, but they look like military. Well, I guess I got to go with it. There's this other crime called impersonating a police officer, but I'm not sure about impersonating a military guy with long guns and walking up and taking people and snatching them. But if it's backed by the federal government, anything's legal.
You're 100% right. It's just intimidation. I've been thinking that same thing since the first days of that footage coming out in Portland. It's like, you're not in the desert. Like, I can see you. You're right there. In fact, I can see you easier because you're the only thing I see that's desert.
Yep.
And the rest isn't desert. No, it's just they put on the helmets and they, you know, they wield the weapons. It's to scare people off. It is to terrorize people. And not even specifically to terrorize the people that are there. Yes, to do that. But to send out a signal to the country that this is all really scary. And it's those terrorists that are protesting that are causing all these problems. So vote for Trump because he's the guy who's protecting you because he's put soldiers in the streets. You know, it turns out that even some of the soldiers don't like it. The Department of Homeland Security's response to anti-police brutality protests in Portland has disturbed and angered many employees who call the deployment of the federal force an unusual maneuver that could do long-term damage to the agency's reputation. Gee, do you think? Do you think they see months of cops brutalizing people and the country turns against those cops? Do you want to be the troops that then get lumped in with that? But they are now. They're there and they're serving.
Yep.
And you know what this does? People.
The way that Trump characterized this action in Portland when he was saying he's going to send it to other cities was, look what happened in Portland. We sent them in and they're handling that and it's beautiful. Nothing about this is beautiful. But if you want to excite the president, then some people who look like military start attacking American citizens. He gets amped up on that. that satisfies him. We already know the approach for many people surrounding this president is to satisfy all of his ridiculous needs and his fill his stomach with any kind of courage that he lacks. So he can bounce off this and say, that's my military going there and assaulting citizens. That makes me feel good. I'm a stronger person now.
Yeah. And what I don't get about all the talk about not retreating and how they're going to send these troops to other places and like, it's just his violence. We just have to fight back against his violence is there's no acknowledgement months into these protests now that maybe something, anything should change. The military situation will change. They'll change that. But nothing, there's no, like Chad Wolf will do 100 interviews and he'll never say, well, you know, I heard a couple of their points and I think there might actually be something to that. It is just a movement to be crushed, despite the fact that a new poll shows 94% of Americans back criminal justice reform. That's not enough. Months of protest and 94% of the American public is not enough to have our leaders acknowledge that maybe anything at all should change. Now, when you break it down, black Americans are much more likely than whites to want major police reform, just under 90%. However, a slight majority of white Americans did agree major police reform was needed. So that's when you break it down to how big should the reform be? Even white Americans, a majority say, yes, major reform needs to be implemented. But the issue is that when you break it down another way, you see that only 14% of Republicans said major reform is needed, compared to nearly 90% of Democrats and 60% of independent voters. I mean, look, even most Republicans say that minor changes need to be made, but they certainly don't want massive change. And that appears to be enough for them to say, rather than giving an inch and actually hearing people out and providing some justice, we will crush people in the streets of an ever-increasing number of American cities week after week, month after month. And we don't care. We don't care what happens to them.
Right up. That's the way they want to see it. And this is a campaign issue. As we've seen, he's making it very partisan. He's talking about how he's going to these blue cities and these weak Democrat-controlled cities and states. If you've gone there immediately, he's pulling out every way he can and all these different policies, different approaches, from his singular now COVID response briefings to these things happening in Portland to then spreading it to other cities. This is all his plan for re-election because he thinks this is going to work. This is what's worked from before. Just a strong arm, a-hole leader who's going to run around and start taking people and throw them in the cars, but he thinks that's going to work. He wants to spread it. That's what his base, he thinks his base wants. We're going to find out.
Yesterday, the acting Secretary of Homeland Security had a quote that a lot of people immediately thought brought to mind sci-fi movies like Minority Report. I want to show you this. Chad Wolf being asked about the fact that his mostly anonymous camoed soldiers that have been deployed to Portland and soon coming to other cities are just snatching people off the streets.
Anytime that you attack a federal facility, such as a courthouse there in Portland, that is a federal crime. Attacking federal police officers, law enforcement officers, which they have done for 52 nights in a row, is a federal crime. And so the department, because we don't have that local support, that local law enforcement support, we are having to go out and proactively arrest individuals. And we need to do that because we need to hold them accountable. This idea that they can attack federal property and law enforcement officers and go to the other side of the street and say, you can't touch me, is ridiculous.
So, yeah, a lot of people thought that having this person who has an incredible amount of apparently unchecked and uncheckable power to brutalize people around the country, saying that they're going to do proactive arrests, that is not how our system is supposed to work. Do you think that he just misspoke?
No. There's like people at this level, and you just mentioned speaking off the cuff because we're doing this show, and you know the term you used, Warren, versus the actual reality of the situation, it comes in speaking. People at this level, when you're on TV and you have a policy and you're implementing this thing where you're carrying out in the cities, you don't misspeak on something like that. You're saying what your policy is. And it tracks because he also said, I don't care what governors and mayors of cities have to say. We're going to come in and do what we want in your cities and in your states. That wasn't misspeaking either. That's what his policy is. Mm-hmm. His policy is also this, that we're going to, he didn't use the word preemptively, proactively start arresting people. Okay. I've seen many posts from police officers in Facebook groups saying what they want to do to citizens and the violent acts they're going to do to them, which are quite illegal. Are we going to proactively start arresting these officers that we've seen saying these things? Because that's a crime. They're planning it. They said they're willing to do it. I think to protect the citizens, We need to start arresting these cops every time we see them say something that's illegal, some kind of action that they want to do that's illegal on a Facebook page. Hey, what if they are caught on body cam saying they're going to do something to these guys? Or, hey, we're going to, you know, we've seen them talk about what they're going to do to people and laugh and joke about it. Pretty illegal, I think, to assault protesters that aren't doing anything to you. Are we going to start arresting them before they do it?
Yeah.
No, but we can do it to citizens because we were trying to protect. I'm not sure which facilities we're talking about protecting here. Outside of
some statue or election building. Yeah, they can and they do. And that's the thing where, like, the reason this quote really struck people is not because, oh, we got him because he said it. No, they've already done it. We have the footage of them just rolling up on people, grabbing people. There's nothing going on. It's no protest. There's no riot or anything like that. They grab people, they put them in the truck, and they drive them off. That is a proactive arrest. I don't care if he finesses his language later on. That's what it is. And people are rightfully horrified. I want to show you a video from Portland. This is from just last night, by the way. This was Joshua Potash on Twitter had this. Take a look at this, and you tell me if this is what the relationship between the U.S. military is supposed to be with American citizens who are protesting.
Watch behind you! Behind you! Behind you! Behind you! Come on! Get! Watch out! Watch out!
Yeah, if I had told you that that was footage taken on, you know, the streets of an Iraqi city back during the surge, you would have believed it.
Mm-hmm.
Totally needless. And when we have these concerns, when we express them, as we have been for some time, they respond by saying, like Chad Wolf saying, our federal agents will not retreat. What do you mean retreat?
Retreat.
This isn't the Battle of the Bulge. What are you talking about? We're saying stop kidnapping people. Stop brutalizing people. You're not in a battle. I need him to confirm that he knows that this is not a battle that he's involved in. That he they're can't. Supposed to be guarding statues.
He can't confirm that because that's not what he believes. He does believe it's a battle. They're amped about this battle. They put these guys in military fatigues. Think about it. They got them in camo. What's camo for? They got like desert camo on, at least from some of the ones that ran up and snatched people and threw them into vans. They got desert camo on. Camouflage is to blend in with the surroundings so you can't be detected as well. What part about the city of Portland has desert and sand all over the place where you have to blend in with the background to make sure that the enemy residents of Portland notice you coming? No, this is an intimidation look. You walk in there with your big guns and your camo, and people have this respect for the military, and that's what you're posing as. Because people go, oh, man, I guess I can't do anything about this because I don't know who they are, but they look like military. Well, I guess I got to go with it. There's this other crime called impersonating a police officer, but I'm not sure about impersonating a military guy with long guns and walking up and taking people and snatching. But if it's backed by the federal government, anything is legal.
You're 100% right. It's just intimidation. I've been thinking that same thing since the first days of that footage coming out in Portland. It's like, you're not in the desert. Like, I can see you. You're right there. In fact, I can see you easier because you're the only thing I see that's desert.
Yep.
And the rest isn't desert. No, it's just they put on the helmets and they, you know, they wield the weapons. It's to scare people off. It is to terrorize people. And not even specifically to terrorize the people that are there. Yes, to do that. But to send out a signal to the country that this is all really scary. And it's those terrorists that are protesting that are causing all these problems. So vote for Trump because he's the guy who's protecting you because he's put soldiers in the streets. You know, it turns out that even some of the soldiers don't like it. The Department of Homeland Security's response to anti-police brutality protests in Portland has disturbed and angered many employees who call the deployment of the federal force an unusual maneuver that could do long-term damage to the agency's reputation. Gee, do you think? Do you think? They see months of cops brutalizing people and the country turns against those cops. Do you want to be the troops that then get lumped in with that? But they are now. They're there and they're serving.
Yep. And they're kidnapping people. The way that Trump characterized this action in Portland when he was saying he's going to send it to other cities was, look what happened in Portland. We sent them in and they're handling that and it's beautiful. Nothing about this is beautiful. But if you want to excite the president, Then there's some people who look like military and start attacking American citizens. He gets amped up on that. That satisfies him. We already know the approach for many people surrounding this president is to satisfy all of his ridiculous needs and his fill his stomach with any kind of courage that he lacks. So he can bounce off this and say, that's my military going there and assaulting citizens. That makes me feel good. I'm a stronger person now.
Yeah. And what I don't get about all the talk about not retreating and how they're going to send these troops to other places and like, it's just this violence. We just have to fight back against this violence is there's no acknowledgement months into these protests now that maybe something, anything should change. The military situation will change. They'll change that. But nothing, there's no, like Chad Wolf will do 100 interviews and he'll never say, well, you know, I heard a couple of their points and I think there might actually be something to that. It is just a movement to be crushed, despite the fact that a new poll shows 94% of Americans back criminal justice reform. That's not enough. Months of protest and 94% of the American public is not enough to have our leaders acknowledge that maybe anything at all should change. Now, when you break it down, black Americans are much more likely than whites to want major police reform, just under 90%. However, a slight majority of white Americans did agree major police reform was needed. So that's when you break it down to how big should the reform be? Even white Americans, a majority say, yes, major reform needs to be implemented. But the issue is that when you break it down another way, you see that only 14% of Republicans said major reform is needed, compared to nearly 90% of Democrats and 60% of independent voters. I mean, look, even most Republicans say that minor changes need to be made, but they certainly don't want massive change. And that appears to be enough for them to say, rather than giving an inch and actually hearing people out and providing some justice, we will crush people in the streets of an ever-increasing number of American cities week after week, month after month. And we don't care. We don't care what happens to them.
Right up. That's the way they want to see it. And this is a campaign issue, as we've seen. He's making it very partisan. He's talking about how he's going to these blue cities and these weak Democrat-controlled cities and states. If you've gone there immediately, he's pulling out every way he can and all these different policies, different approaches, from his singular now COVID response briefings to these things happen in Portland to then spreading it to other cities. This is all his plan for re-election because he thinks this is going to work. This is what's worked from before. Just a strong arm, a-hole leader who's going to run around and start taking people and throw them in the cars, but he thinks that's going to work. He wants to spread it. That's what his base, he thinks his base wants. We're going to find out.
Yesterday, we talked about how Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was accosted by Representative Ted Yoho, as well as one other, screaming at her, calling her disgusting, and then after the conversation, declaring that she was an effing bitch. Now, she mostly at the time identified that it happened, but sort of brushed it off, posting on Instagram this. Now, we can't play the song, but it's Boss Bitch by Doja Cat. You should go on her Instagram. It's great. It got me fired up today.
There's a hero right there, John. There's a hero.
That is a hero. That after that, she's just playing music and she's, by the way, wearing the mask. Good to see. That's leadership. Now, following all of that, Ted Yoho went to the House floor to apologize. And I want to play you a portion of what he said, and we're going to evaluate whether he actually did or not.
I rise to apologize for the abrupt manner of the conversation I had with my colleague from New York. It is true that we disagree on policies and visions for America, but that does not mean we should be disrespectful. Having been married for 45 years with two daughters, I'm very cognizant of my language. The offensive name-calling words attributed to me by the press were never spoken to my colleagues, and if they were construed that way, I apologize for their misunderstanding. As my colleagues know, I'm passionate about those affected by poverty. I cannot apologize for my passion or for loving my God, my family, and my country. I yield back.
That's terrible in a lot of ways. So, JR, I want to go to you first because you were the person who asked him to apologize for his passion and for his God and his love of his country. That was a thing that was asked of him. So it makes sense that he would respond that he can't, JR.
I'm glad he bravely stepped up to the table and apologized for people misinterpreting what he said to AOC. Mm-hmm. I apologize for you guys not hearing it right after someone heard it right and I denied it. That's the apology. Oh, and I apologize for the abrupt conversation, not the aggressive, cuss-filled conversation I had with a colleague of mine on the Capitol steps and yelling and wagging my finger in her face. None of that. No, none of that happened. Actually, who is this random person? What are you apologizing for? Did you name someone? Mm-hmm. I didn't hear any names there. Could have been anybody, right? Maybe it could have been a Republican who just, you know, he had a disagreement about lunch. He wanted sushi. The other one wanted burgers. So they got mad at each other and yelled a little bit. Who knows? We never know. We didn't get the full story. But he wants to apologize for you guys misinterpreting that entire passionate reaction. By the way, a part of this that we cut out from that was he knows about poverty. He and his wife got together in 19 and they were on food stamps. And he decided to try and pull up a few tears, which he couldn't get out because he's a horrible actor. All that was tried. It's best to just stay quiet. Just mm-hmm. stay quiet because we already know. All you told us is that I really don't care about this. And anyone who's really listening to me knows that I don't care about this. And I meant every word of it.
Exactly. Yeah, it's he said the word apologize, but he did every weaselly little wormy thing he can do to not do it. And especially, I think you do have to say the person's name. I think that's kind of an important part. Weird to not do that. Now, AOC evaluated his apology, and here's what she had to say. Does not apologize or name any action he did. Doesn't accept responsibility. Lies. It wasn't a conversation. It was a verbal assault. Distracts by making it about poverty, ironically, since Absolutely. That's what he was assaulting her about. Absolutely. Says everyone else is wrong, and the incident never happened. This is not an apology. And she actually asked Politico to take down a tweet implying that he had apologized. She said she was going to train her nieces, I think, to know that this is not an apology, and says he didn't even say my name. Yeah. And by the way, look at the Weasley thing he said. The words that are attributed to me were not said to my colleague. I get what you're doing there, because we know that you guys turned and walked away, and then you were overheard saying it, you little weasel. We know that you didn't say it directly to her. You said it about her in range of a reporter. What a weaselly thing. And he wouldn't admit what it was. And he says, thanks to the fact that I have a wife and a daughter, I've learned to be very careful with my language.
Oh.
You had to have that to know that you're not supposed to call one of your female colleagues an effing bitch? You had to be trained into that over time?
Well, apparently that training hasn't finished because he did it.
He did it, yeah.
So, like, I got a couple, which is, it's the equivalent of one of my best friends is black, therefore I'm not a racist. So, therefore, you've got a wife and two daughters, and therefore you didn't do this because of them? They must be very disappointed in you. Mm-hmm. But when you go home, they go like, yeah, I guess, you know, we still have some work to do here, Ted.
Yeah.
What are we here for? For your cover. That's what they're there for.
And by the way, she said too, I don't remember exactly what the tweet is, but she said something to the effect of her initial comments had been that extreme poverty and being deprived creates a trauma. That sometimes people they commit crimes because they need to eat, literally. It has an effect on people. And he says, I only did all of this because I'm so passionate about poverty. And she acknowledges, what you did was run up and accost me and yell in my face and swear at me. But your point is that poverty doesn't have negative ramifications. But you're exactly. demonstrating that it does. And nowhere does he admit there that he's going to try to learn or try to evolve in any way. He just pretends, I'm too passionate, and I won't apologize for my passion. If I ever get accused of cheating, I'm just going to say, I will never apologize for my passion. No, an apology isn't about listing all of the things you won't apologize about that no one has asked you to apologize about. We didn't even specifically ask you to apologize about this, but if you're going to, maybe do that. That would be a good thing to do during an apology, to apologize.
No.
And he was reading it. He was reading it as well.
Yeah. Come on, bro.
And by the way, in the zone of AOC apologies, this is a bad one, maybe the worst. But just in the past couple of days, Brian Kilmeade tweeted out a Photoshop tweet of AOC's implying that she wanted to keep all businesses locked down to hurt Donald Trump in the election explicitly. It was totally made up, doesn't exist. It had already been debunked, but he tweeted it. He eventually took it down after everybody raised a stink about it, and he tweeted out that he apologizes, but the tweet had quotation marks implying that he had copied and pasted it from like a PR thing or something like that.
That was his reason.
And he got her name wrong in the apology.
Wait, that I didn't know he did this.
Yes, it's true. It's true.
I'm sorry, guys. You know, I just went on the internet and I reposted something from some rando but it had quotation marks. They went through the trouble of pressing shift quotation mark buttons on their computer to fake this tweet. Therefore, it's real, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. Okay, JR. I think that's about all the time we got, but I want to thank you for joining us. We fit a lot into a little bit of time. I don't know about you. I'm exhausted now.
I totally. Absolutely. I know we've been living in an upside down world, but somehow, like, I'm finally falling from the floor to the ceiling and hitting my head.
Well, after you rebound off the ceiling, you're going to land in what looks like a very comfortable chair. So glad for that.
I'm going to hold on.
Very excited to welcome to the show for the first time, congressional candidate running in Massachusetts 4th District, Ihsan Likee. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Very glad to have you here, and interested to learn about your platform, what you intend to do if you get elected. Before we jump into that, though, this is the first office that you're running for?
That's right. I'm a federal regulator. I worked at the Federal Reserve to regulate the biggest banks in our country who had received the bailouts in 2008. And to make sure that we don't have to bail them out again and to catch their lies.
Exactly. And we have some of those concerns based on some of the bailouts that have been part of the pandemic response funding. But I wanted to find out more about your decision to run. You're running for the congressional seat that's being vacated for Kennedy, who is running his primary challenge on the Senate level. So when was that decision made, and what was your thought process when you were deciding to make the launch from being on sort of the bureaucratic side to running for office?
Well, as you know, we live through multiple crises right now. The COVID pandemic that took the lives of over 130,000 people. We have a government that called it a hoax before it started to do anything to help us out. And we have millions of people who have lost their jobs and lost their health insurance and can't put food on the table. All this in the midst of the environmental emergency that's putting the Arctic on fire and the Amazon on fire. But we also understand that these issues existed before COVID, and that, you know, when we see now, for example, the effects on communities of color being disproportionately losing loved ones, that those are the results of hundreds of years of systemic racism in our country that hasn't been addressed. Same with healthcare, same with environmental justice, and so on. So my decision to challenge Congressman Joe Kennedy came from multiple frustrations about the direction that our country was taking and the complacency that I was seeing in Congress. And especially as a Wall Street regulator, that I saw, I saw Democrats voting to deregulate, to give more power to Wall Street in a time where we shouldn't have. And there's of course, the personal lived experiences aspect, being a woman of color, being a Muslim woman, being an immigrant, being someone who has lived in poverty in the richest country in the world, I was driven to do everything that I can to dismantle oppressive systems that stand between us and the America we dream of.
And you've talked about your time as a regulator. It is an interesting time that we live in, where I think just in the past week I saw news that Kennedy was going to be involved in a hearing with pharma companies. I believe it was pharma that he had personally invested a significant quantity of money in, and still held those investments while the hearing was going on. And we're just a couple of months out from multiple representatives and senators, dumping stock or buying up new stocks as they were being briefed about the pandemic, but hiding information. I'm curious, your history, being a regulator, how would that affect the way you would address some of these and other issues were you to hold the office?
Well, the first thing I would start with is closing the revolving door. When I was a regulator at the Fed, I saw how my colleagues chose to get out of the Fed, especially during regulation, walk across the street to the banks like State Street, Morgan Stanley, and Goldman Sachs, and triple their salaries. And that created a very, very difficult way for us to regulate, because all of a sudden these banks know what we're doing at the Fed. They know our models. They know what we're trying to, what methods we're using to try to find their lies. And we had to recreate the wheel over and over. But that revolving door is also between the Wall Street and Washington, right? Where you see the top executives of Goldman Sachs becoming Trump's advisors and allies. And that's got to end, so we can actually have regulatory agencies that work for the people, and we can have a Congress that works for the people. And that's why I don't take any money from corporate PACs or lobbyists or fossil fuel executives. The list is really long to be committed to the people at 100%.
You know, I know that one of your key priorities is a green recovery plan. I'd love to hear about how you see that being implemented, what should be a part of it. But I'm also curious if you think perhaps there's any way that some of the continuing conversations about how we should respond to the pandemic, should some of the sorts of philosophical underpinnings of a recovery plan like yours be a part of the conversation right now?
I absolutely. I think that the Green Economic Recovery Plan addresses some of the deep issues that we have. It builds on the Green New Deal, and it addresses the issues of the communities on the front lines that have been denied economic opportunity for generations, and how we're going to create those opportunities for them at this time as we safely go back into reopening the economy. But before we go into the recovery, we have to immediately address relief. And relief hasn't been addressed the right way in this country. We need to urgently give $2,000 a month for the period of the pandemic and beyond to every individual in our country. This will help people put food on the table. This will help people continue to have some level of dignity in their lives. We have to usher in Medicare for all. Immediately, we have to make sure that people have healthcare. How are we going to treat a pandemic when people cannot call a doctor when they're sick? And so the urgency of relief, it shouldn't only be looked at as an economic urgency. It's a humanitarian urgency. These are the lives of our people, and we have to make sure that everybody is living a life with dignity in the richest country in the world.
And looking forward in terms of, you know, addressing climate change and all of that, let's say that hypothetically, November comes, you're elected. Let's say that Trump is thrown out and Biden is put in. Biden has his new climate plan, which is, you know, more in line with what some progressive activists are pushing for. But he has a history of saying that he doesn't support banning fracking or those sorts of things. How do you see your role with Biden in office in terms of moving him to where he needs to be on this particular issue?
Well, I mean, that's the beauty of electing bold progressives across the country, is that we unapologetically stand up for justice and for the people. You know, I'm someone who grew up in Morocco, and in the summertime, we lost water. And when the water came back, it tasted like bleach. And in my district, I met with single mothers who are spending over $65 a month to buy clean water for their children, because both our infrastructure is crumbling and the fossil fuel companies have power over polluting the water we drink. And so that's gonna end. I believe that, you know, that Biden will have a listening ear that will tend to justice and will tend to what the people need. And we're gonna need to push him on that. That's what democracy is about.
Yeah. Well, we're not to Biden yet. We still got Trump. And in one of your campaign ads, you refer to yourself as his greatest nightmare. Oh, why is that?
Look, I was that girl that you walk by the sandwich shop and you see her, you know, making sandwiches, mopping the floor, and you're like, yeah, she's there. You don't know what's going on in her life. You don't know if she's been sexually harassed or suffered wage thefts. You don't know any of that. You see her, she's there. That same girl fought the biggest banks on Wall Street. And that same girl is willing and going to fight the biggest oppressive systems that have stopped us from having the American dream that I came here for. That American dream means that everyone in this country has their basic necessities to live. That's shelter, healthcare, an education, and a dignified job with dignified pay, clean air and clean water. I don't think we're asking for something that is unachievable. After all, this is America. This is the richest country in the world, most powerful country in the world. And anyone who will come in the way of dismantling my American dream and the American dream of all the people in our country will have to face the consequences.
Okay. And you know, if someone's watching this and they want to find out more about your background, your platform, where can they get that information?
You can learn more at ihsane.org. It's ihssane.org. Please do join us. We ask that you help us make calls, send out texts, and bring more relational organizing to this movement building campaign. We are a multi-generational, multi-racial movement who is going to spearhead the bold progressive movement in Massachusetts and across the country.
Ihsan, thank you so much. Appreciate you joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.